Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, hello, my wonderful audience. I'm going to skip just showing my appreciation to you in more detail, like I do with every other time I've been on the air, because we have news. Stephen Paddock, the worst mass murderer in U.S. history, was prescribed benzodiazepines in the form of 50 10-milligram Valium tablets on June 21st. So he had at least 50 of these between June 21st and today. I've received an unconfirmed report. This is not factual like this other one seems to be. Some of my sources are telling me that he was also being given antidepressants. Now, the information received, according to the press, and you can get this by going to Breggin.com. It's alert 18. It's my alert today, my frequent alert. And the information was gotten from the Nevada Prescription Monitoring Program, PMP. That's for Prescription Monitoring Program. That only monitors, as it does in my own state of New York and elsewhere, only monitors what are called scheduled drugs. So the doctors would not have called in to report their patient had been given antidepressant, if that's the case. But he would have, by law, been required to call in that he was given prescribed drugs that are addictive, such as the benzodiazepines and Valium. This is not going to necessarily tell us whether he got additional prescriptions from this particular doctor. It depends on the state and the doctor and whether the doctor is going to check in on a regular basis every time he prescribes. So that's the information we have right now. He was given Valium, and he could have had taking it on and off. He certainly could have stretched that up through this period of time, or he could have taken a lot of it beforehand. We don't know. We don't know how long he was getting the building up all this ammunition. So that's what we have right now. There's no question at all that benzodiazepines are associated with increased violence. That has been known for a very long time, decades. And it acts very much like alcohol. It produces a disinhibition, lets anger come out. You know, so much violence is associated with alcohol. Very similar effects on neurotransmitters to alcohol, especially the GABA receptors. But the patient, the individual taking the drugs, does not expect to be feeling violent, doesn't have any social reinforcement or learning that would tell them these drugs are like alcohol, you're not in your right mind if you're taking them. And they can produce very great changes without negative changes in the person's personality and activities without making the individual look grossly drunk. So we're in a situation now where, like so many, many others, we have at least an association with the recent prescription of one psychiatric drug at this point, Valium. We will see what comes out as we move along. And please check my frequent alerts. I'll put up, it's right at the top of my page on Breggin.com, Breggin.com, of course. And I will, the moment I hear information, if I'm up at 1 in the morning, you know, and I get some information, I'll get it onto my alert as quickly as possible. this is such a tragedy, this mass murder. It's I'm a resident psychiatrist on George Norrie's Coast to Coast. I talked about it last night with George on his radio station to millions and millions of listeners, and told him, suggested to him that, you know, don't use this divisively in terms of politics. We've now had mass murders of toddlers, practically, in Connecticut. We've had children of all ages mass murders. We've had African Americans in church shot down. We've had gay people shot down in Florida. Women, men. You know, this, and now, of course, people who tend to be more on the right, who are, you know, who are at a folk music, not a folk music, but a festival of country western. And, you know, it's all of us. It's our culture that's under siege. And we need to unite from all directions about this. And we need to be empathic to all and caring toward all the members of our culture and what each of them as individuals and groups struggle with. As an individual, don't let this blow you away and crush you. Life has always been hard for us human beings. I was alive during World War II, not one, but two, hiding under desks. My dad was an air raid warden. We thought a blockbuster could come and destroy all of our houses. The blockbuster was the great fear. And we had submarines probably a couple miles away off the coast of Long Island, where I lived. And then I went through, the Cold War and the terrors that everybody felt about atomic war. So listen, folks, life is always tough. Let it inspire you to be stronger, to do more, to take better care of yourself, your family, your loved ones, and see if there's some way you want to engage the culture in a more meaningful way. Wow, it's not easy being a human being. Never was. Nobody promised us it would be. If they did, they were lying to you. But with good values, with good relationships, we can survive and thrive. And today I'm going to be talking with my friend Jeannie Stolzer, who's been on before. Jeannie, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, Jeannie is a world expert on relationships and from a very scientific viewpoint, not from psychobabble. No psychobabble in my friend Jeannie. And I'm having her on again at this time because we are going to be at that conference that I want to mention to you once again, which is the Pam Popper runs this conference, and she's invited me to co-sponsor this year, which I'm delighted to do. And the conference is Columbus, Ohio, November 9th. I'll be arriving, and the conference is the 10th, 11th. And it's a conference that deals with two interrelated issues that I am more and more addressing now. One is that good nutrition makes for a healthy body, and good relationships make for a healthy emotional life. So we feed our body with good nutrition, we feed our minds with good relationships, and we're bringing this together. Jeannie and I work, not Jeannie, I think of Jeannie together with Pam. Pam and I are working on a book about this that I hope will materialize someday. You never know about books. I'm going to be talking about the why and how to stop taking neurotoxic psychiatric drugs. And I'm going to be talking about empathic therapy. And my friend Peter Gerze, I've invited him over as co-sponsor of the conference. I've invited Jeannie to come. And I've invited Peter Gerze to also come from Denmark. And for those of you who aren't really on top of what's going on in the psychiatric reform or critical psychiatry movement, Peter Gerze is a genius. He's a man who helped found the Cochrane collaboration, which is an international group of doctors who try to monitor the medical literature and get at what is good science. And he has just written marvelous books, and including Deadly Psychiatry and Organized Denial, and he's going to be there. Now, Jeannie is just a dear friend of mine. She's a professor at Nebraska, in university in Kearney, Nebraska. She's a specialist in child development and other related things. She writes scientific papers on relationship and early childhood. And if we're going to solve our human problems in any way at all, folks, we're going to have to start with our relationships to the unborn child, the newborn child, and the young child. I've never quite put it that way before, but I'm laying it out on the right there. We're going to solve our human problems. We are going to have to begin with improving our relationships to the unborn child, to the newborn child, and to the young child. Jeannie, that's not a bad motto, is it?
That is perfect. It is so perfectly stated. That's exactly right, and that's why I'm so passionate about what I do and have done for decades. You're right. You're absolutely right. We're not going to solve this if we're going to start working on people when they're 48. We have to start from the very beginning.
We know from a combination of modern science, looking at child development and human development, and looking at evolution, both biological and cultural evolution, that the mainstays of good development are nutrition and relationship. Human beings are born to relationship. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that we human beings are in the womb relating to you. Hi, is Jeannie back?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, great. Jeannie's back. So what I was just saying, Jeannie, is, you know, we have a lot of evidence from evolution and from modern science that what human beings depend upon is good nutrition and good relationships. There's just no way about away from having to pay attention to that. And I might add, folks, and you're hearing me talk more and more about nutrition, that without good nutrition, everything gets worse. And I've talked about good nutrition in the past on the show. I'm going to talk about it on November 1st with Pam Popper, the nutritionist, so hang in there for November 1st. And I've talked about it very directly with Pam on October 11th. You can go to my website, Bregan.com, look under the highlights at the top, plug into radio, and then you can actually, we have a search mechanism now where you can actually search Popper, and you'll get to the last show with Pam, which is all about nutrition. And it's not, you know, fake stuff like, you know, buy my nutritional supplement, all that's nonsense. It's about how we've always eaten, what the base foods are, what really works, and what poisons us. For example, most people are poisoning themselves with dairy products. We didn't evolve to use dairy products. So that's just a taste. How's that for a taste? I gave you a taste on the nutrition. Let me give you back to Jeannie. And Jeannie, pick up on this theme of relationship in the womb, relationship in infancy, relationship in childhood.
I still have a really bad connection. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, so I'm trying my best, but it's very staticky on my end. But I do want to talk a little bit about what you said about nutrition, because you're right up my alley now, because I've published, I don't even know how many scientific papers on the importance of breastfeeding. And again, if we're going to start talking about nutrition, we have to begin from the very earliest nutrition, and that's from our mother. And when that's not done, we suffer all types of problems nutritionally, from Crohn's disease to all types of gastro, problems. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So I think you're absolutely right. And dairy, now that you're speaking about it, think of what the very first ingredient is in baby formula. It's dairy. So we start these brand new babies, just out of the womb, hours old, on dairy products. And then when they start throwing up and, you know, are constipated or diarrhea because they're reacting to a cow's milk, which, by the way, a cow has four stomachs, and we don't. We're not meant to digest that type of milk. Then we put them on soya milk, when, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, a baby human should never be on soya formula, as it can result in anaphylactic shock. So from the very beginning, we're messing with our systems in this country.
Well, I want you to just keep talking about this, Jeannie, okay?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to talk about when we're talking about breastfeeding, absolutely, is not only the attachment issue, but how we have so sexualized the female breast that we can't even talk about breastfeeding without feeling a whole bunch of cognitive dissonance. Oh, you know, that's a sexual act. No, it's not. It's the most maternal, it's the cement of the bonding experience in all mammals, and has been, you know, since the Mesozoic age when the first mammal appeared here, that shrew-like little creature you write about in your book.
My book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, because it's based on evolutionary understanding of those terrible emotions. Yes.
Yeah, so when you look at weaning rates in the world, I mean, it's just astronomical when you look at the United States. Right now, we're coming in at 6 weeks. That's our weaning rate. Of course, it's not a magical number, but that's when women have to go back to work because of policies. But when you collapse the whole world down with regard to worldwide weaning rates, you come in at about 3.2 years.
Wow.
So we're super outliers in this area, super outliers.
And
we've so sexualized breasts, we can't even have conversations around it, you know, with a scientific basis, because culturally we're so aghast at what we, you know, what we're perceiving.
Yeah, that number, I've heard you give those numbers before, and it always seems so long to me. And tell us, what do we get out of being breastfed for 2, 3, or 4 years?
Well, a lot of things, and I think most people only think of breastfeeding as nutrition, and of course it's the perfect nutrition for a human. I mean, you can't touch it with cow-based formula or with soya-based formula. You can't touch it. But it's not only nutrition, as I said before, it's the cementing of the attachment process. But I think when people start hearing about, oh my God, he was nursing it 3 years, they have to understand how it's done. When you have a brand new baby, and it doesn't matter if it's a kitten or a human, they're nursing constantly. That's what newborn mammals do. They nurse and they nurse and they nurse and they nurse, and the poor mother is like, oh my God, you know, this baby's not doing anything but nursing. And as the baby gets older, then feedings are spread out. It's very, very gradual. So a three-year-old will probably be nursing probably at night, you know, and probably to go night-night to go to sleep, and probably if they fall down and hurt their, you know, their knee. It's not this constant nursing, and of course they're eating other very healthy organic foods, but they're still nursing. And what it does with a major function as far as health goes is the immune system. When we're born as humans, our immune system is not functional. It's very, very immature. We're getting our mother's antibodies where we should be immediately from her breast milk. And as she continues to breastfeed us throughout early childhood, the immunities crank up. And in doing that, what happens to our immune system is it becomes this warrior-like machine. That's why you have places in sub-Saharan Africa that don't have any allergies. None. It's unknown because the immune system is so strong. But here, you know, most of us know people with all kinds of gut diseases and all types of allergies, and we wonder why that is. All our immune systems, you know, were assaulted from the very beginning, and they didn't get to function as our ancestors did. So, yeah, there's a medical reason to nurse that long, and, of course, a socio-emotional reason to cement attachment.
And one of the things that immediately comes to my mind is that the mother's milk will never have a substitute immunologically, because it has been specifically developed most often right around the environment in which she's nursing the baby. So if the mother has lived in upstate New York for years and now is nursing a baby in upstate New York, she has an immunological system that is perfect for the baby. You're not going to be able to bottle that, ever.
No, and that's why it's so critical. It's called the shared environment. And you have to be with your baby in order to produce the antibodies that are needed for that child's environment. If I'm working as a district court judge and my child is at Happy Folks Daycare, I am not producing antibodies for her environment. I'm producing antibodies for my environment. That's why anthropologists talk to us about the importance of the shared environment and the importance when it comes to breastfeeding. So I'm producing specific antibodies for the pathogens that my child is exposed to.
So there's a scientific body of literature about this, folks. This is not Jeannie Stolzer, Dr. Stolzer, PhD, just herself, professor of child development. This is not just herself saying these things. There's people around the world talking about these issues, the importance of nursing.
Oh, I mean, look at Dr. Gruley's work. It's spelled G-R-U-L-E-E. He's publishing in the early 1920s in the medical journals, clearly showing that babies who are breastfed long-term are much, 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 much healthier than babies who are formula-fed. This is in the 20s. We've known this since the 1920s. So, yes, I'm just adding all my decades of publishing in this area. I'm just adding. We've been knowing this for, you know, 90-plus years. What we're just finding out in the last 15 years is the benefits for mom. That's the new thing. And, you know, we should be ashamed of ourselves because we just left mom out of the equation. And now we know for certain when she nurses long-term, and long-term is 2.5 years or longer in the medical literature, she's significantly less likely to develop osteoporosis, rheumatoid arthritis, heart disease, stroke, all types of diabetes, types 1 and types 2. What am I forgetting? Anxiety, depression, mood disorders. I'm forgetting something really important. But for mother, see, it's sort of this dyadic relationship. For years, we thought, oh, you know, how healthy for the child and through the child's lifespan, how wonderful. No, no, no. It's mother, too. And these findings are through her life. She is much less likely to die of a stroke or a heart attack if she's breastfed long-term. This is a dyadic, symbiotic relationship that's been forged throughout millions of years of evolutionary time. And we just sort of thumb our nose at it in 2017 in America. And then we wonder why we're so sick.
I think a lot of people are getting a sense that we are getting sicker and sicker. Longevity is being maintained. You know, we have an increased longevity, and I think that's because a lot just public health measures, and I'm sure antibiotics have been helping over the generations, but a lot of it is about cleaner air and water and food that isn't contaminated, and sort of really basic things like that have made such a huge difference for human beings. But in fact, there's a whole range of diseases that have been increasing in numbers beyond that which any primitive people with reasonable or even longer lifespans endured, you know, including diabetes, which you've mentioned already, and heart disease, arthritis, all kinds of immune disorders, endless immune disorders. And a lot of that is the difference in diet. And the other day I was talking with a nutritionist who reminded me that in school, well, this was actually a medical doc who believes much very deeply in nutrition, that when her daughter goes to school, she is told she must take the milk that comes with the school lunch, and she's supposed to drink it. And if she says,
unbelievable.
I don't want it, they say you have to take it. And what is this? This is the U.S. government. And who influences the U.S. government to do things like that? Gee, you think it could be the dairy industry? They wouldn't lobby the U.S. government on nutrition, would they? So Jean,
yes, it's unbelievable. And when you look at Asian countries, they don't touch milk. And you wonder, well, how do they get their calcium? Well, they get their calcium from their rich diets that are green, dark, leafy vegetables, things like sardines. But those children in Asia, their drink is tea, green tea. They don't, milk is never even heard of. But I wanted to say before I forget, I kept saying I'm forgetting something really important with regard to mom's health and breastfeeding. It's a significant decrease in breast, endometrial, and uterine cancer. There are places on our globe that have no breast cancer. So when you say, when your question is, why would anyone long-term breastfeed? Well, one of those things would be to eradicate breast cancer.
This is amazing stuff, Jeannie. How are you doing on the other end? Are you hearing me okay?
It's very, very statically, but I'm rolling with the punches.
You're doing great. We are having no trouble at the studio, and I'm having no trouble on my hardline phone hearing you. So the problem
okay.
is just distressing to you, not distressing to us, and you sound good.
Okay.
It does sound like sometimes you don't exactly hear what I'm saying right away. Is that the case with all the static?
Yeah, it feels like there's a delay and then there's all this static.
Yeah, it sounds to me like I'm talking to you sometimes and there is a little delay or in response. So, folks, that's what's going on. And that's the technological world we live in, but it does give us marvelous opportunities like this show and this conversation. Jeannie, this is so radical. I mean, it would so change our economy, our family life, our social life. To think about mothers, and of course it would so change the prevailing emphasis coming from the women's movement, as we understand it. What do you make out of this? I mean, it would just be earth-shaking for people to hear this, which is why, folks, you're not hearing it.
Yeah, it would be earth-shattering, but according to the United States government, this isn't my data. This is the Surgeon General of the United States. If we just exclusively breastfed for 6 months, just 6 months, we would save $3.5 billion a year in health care costs. If we breastfed for 12 months, just 12 months exclusively, we would save $7 billion a year in health care costs. You talk about radical? That number right there is enough to ensure every man, woman, and child in this country. It is, but we won't do it because we'd have to turn our culture on its head to do it.
Well, we'd have to become parent-centered, mother-centered. You know, some folks have said it takes a village to raise a child, but it actually, a better way of looking at it is it takes a single parent, usually a mother, to raise a child with the help of the village.
That's right. That's right. And when you look at American statistics right now, for me, here's the radical statistics. Approximately 77% of all babies in America, that's 12 months of age and younger, are in full time, that's 40 or more hours per week, non-parental care. To me, the way I think and the way I perceive, that's radical. That has never been done before in any culture at any historical time period. That's staggering.
How does that compare to Europe?
Oh, completely, completely different. But all of these countries have paid maternal leave. There was actually a national cohort study done. I want to say that was 8 years ago, but it could have been nine, the largest study ever conducted. They wanted to find out why so many mothers of young children, 3 years of age and younger, were employed outside of the home. So they asked them, very simple question, why are you employed outside of the home? A, economic necessity. B, personal fulfillment. C, other, and you could write in. 79% of the women surveyed reported that they were working for personal fulfillment. We have actually conned a whole generation of women into believing that it's not
fulfilling to raise your children. We did it.
Yeah.
You have to be personally fulfilled as a lawyer or an orthodontist or a judge. And it's not to say you couldn't be an orthodontist or a judge and be a mother. It's just when they're little, which is such a short, short time period in the scheme of things, that you can't do both. I mean, well, you can, but you can't do both in a stellar way. That's the lie that's been told, that we can do it and we can do both things fabulously. And it's a lie. Something's gonna give.
Wow. I've heard you say this before, obviously. Most of the people listening will not have heard you say it before. But it's one of those things, like the psychiatric drug issue, which is just, as well as all the other drugs we're taking, you know, and using so much of alcohol, marijuana, street drugs, you know, whatever else. It's something that industry pushes for. It's something that at least the left culture pushes for, this women, being exactly like men, and that's wonderful for the kids, you know, because they get to see mom growing up as a more independent, outside the home person. Things I believed for decades, until I really, you know, looked at what was good for my kids growing up and what wasn't, and what's good for children is having a loving mom nursing them at home, just like you're describing. And yet, you know, it's a really serious issue. I mean, have people talked about, well, should mothers be getting nanny substitutes? I don't know what the word nanny refers to, whether it has an African-American implication from our history with slavery. But, but whoever would substitute for a mother, what is that generally called?
Well, I don't know what it's called, but I know that it was Dr. John Bowlby, that proclaimed, and he proclaimed it at the top of his lungs, that baby mammals need their mother or permanent mother substitute for optimal development to occur. That's why he was crucified by modern-day feminists. But it's a fact. Baby mammals need their mothers or permanent mother substitute for optimal development to occur. Why is that so hard for us, the most educated people who've ever been on the planet, to talk about? Of course it's true. I know it doesn't go with our politically correct scripts. I understand that. But the older I get, I don't think I have a politically correct bone in my body. I don't.
Well,
you
have independent thought disorder, as an old friend of mine once said.
What happens
here's
what
with
else
the
I want to say about what I think has happened with women. Not only mm-hmm. have they been conned into believing they could do both fabulously at the same time, but they've also probably most importantly been conned into believing that their worth as a human being is based on their economic earning power. I mean, when did we get to this place that a woman's intrinsic worth is based on her letters behind her name and the money in her bank account, i.e. her economic earning power? It's the craziest thing I've ever heard. The other thing we had to convince women of with this feministic wave that, you know, engulfed us all was that somebody else can raise your child just as good as you ever could have. We've convinced them, and here we are. And Maslow, I love Maslow so much. Do you know he was publishing in the 1940s? In the 1940s!
No, I heard him speak at Harvard in 55.
You did.
No.
In the 40s, he's publishing that children who are not breastfed long-term and do not have a secure attachment with their mothers have significantly more disturbing behavioral problems. And we've known this. We've known it. Maslow was publishing this. And then we do this giant daycare experiment anyway. And then we wonder, why are we having such high levels of anxiety and depression and trust issues and learning problems and behavioral problems? We're mammals. When we don't have a secure foundation, we're messed up all over the place.
Yeah, I know in my studies of chimpanzees, mostly through the work of that marvelous lady from Africa, whose name
Goodall.
Is escaping me. Yeah, Jane Goodall. And I write about this in Toxic Psychiatry at some length, and that is that for chimpanzees, there comes a point at which they're too young, if their mother dies, they're too young to survive, even if another mother tries to take care of them and nurse them. Even if an older brother joins in, as happens sometimes, and then tries to help them, that they need the person to whom they're originally attached to by nursing, even if that person, as in the case of one of the stories, was an inadequate elderly chimpanzee, and that's partially why she died, and she couldn't, and why she kind of spoiled the little chimp, and this chimp died of depression, basically loss. That might depression's horrible word, loss, these attachments matter. And I think Bowlby and his group pointed out that even during the Blitz of Britain, it was better for children to be with their parents than with substitute parents in the suburbs where no bombs were dropping every night. So the horrors of the nightly Blitzkrieg was not as bad for children as being separated from their parents. And this is...
Yes, and those are longitudinal studies. He followed those children up into their 30s and 40s. Many fewer emotional behavioral problems in adulthood, adolescence and adulthood. Those children that had that secure base, so what he taught us, it's not about the storms and stresses in life that wreck us. What wreck us is going through the storms and stressors of life by ourselves, feeling alone and insecure and not loved. That's what wrecks us.
Yeah. It's interesting, Jeannie. I've been trying to think about this very, very interesting interview for me. I've been trying to think about connecting for people the issue of nutrition with the issue of relationship. And, of course, it was staring me right in the face, which is it's the nursing mother. And
it is.
I probably wrote that somewhere in Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety because I talk about these things. But I'm trying to think in my mind, you know, why do you have a conference like the one that's coming up in November? By the way, you can find out about the conference more by just going to Bregan.com and looking at my little section on upcoming events. And right now it's my only upcoming event. I don't do a lot of them, but it's my upcoming event. Why have Pam Popper and Peter Bregan, a nutritionist and a psychiatrist, doing a conference, doing courses together? And if you use your model of nutrition and relationship, it's right there at the start of life. And they remain together in good families where parents insist on eating together with their children. That's another thing we've lost. I'll bet that's built in somewhere in evolution, that parents and children should eat together.
I just thought of a research study that was done in the late 90s. It took children who were breastfed for 3 or more years and compared them to children who were formula-fed and followed their food choices for the next 2 years. And children who were breastfed were much more likely to pick healthy foods such as whole grain-type things, organic type things, fruits and vegetables, things like that. It was a pretty interesting finding by these 3 or 4 authors. But it seems to follow us or to stay with us through life, our nutritional habits. The other thing that stays with us throughout life that most people don't connect the dots with is when we're breastfed, we nurse from our mother until we're full, and that's it. That's it. When we're bottle-fed, a doctor tells the mother he has to drink 7 ounces. So the mother tries her hardest to pump this in this baby. You've all seen it. The formula is running out of the side of the mouth, and the mom's just one more ounce, honey, just one more ounce. So you
Oh, God, I have seen that. Yes.
You stretch their little tummies out from, you know, the day of birth, and then you wonder why we're so obese. And there's clearly studies. I mean, the Surgeon General's reporting this, that there's significant increases in obesity at every age level with formula feeding. I mean, we're the fattest people in the world. There's no doubt about it. But look at our earliest nutrition. Look what we're doing to these babies.
Yeah, we're giving them foods that are alien, foods that have been chemically altered and chemically designed, and maybe that builds in some sort of good taste for things like that. I wonder also about the flavor. One of the things that Pam points out is we sort of flavor bomb people now with these advertisements for foods that are just, you know, they've got on one sandwich, you got a hamburger, you got cheese, you got bacon, you've got an egg. And, you know, you're being just overwhelmed with flavors. Maybe that's another difference between how a child tastes mother's milk, and maybe there's more of a flavor bombardment that's a little unnatural or more intense, maybe from the way they make the formulas. I don't know. Have you thought about that or looked into that at all?
Absolutely. Look at some of the ingredients, or your listeners can do this. Just go to Walmart and pick up a can of formula. You won't be able to pronounce probably 80% of the things that are in there, but some things you'll be able to pronounce, like beef tallow and like palm kernel oil. You know what that is. Yeah, there is this sort of blitz of fats and unnatural fats that we can't digest in baby formula. Absolutely. I've written about it for 15 years.
Well, we got to get your work out more, and I'm so glad I'm having you at the conference November 10th, and just so good to be talking to you.
I'm so excited about the conference. It's going to be a great one. I hope some of your listeners will be able to come, because it really is going to be a great one. When you have Bregan and Popper co-sponsoring something, I mean, it doesn't get better than that. So I think it will be amazing.
Yeah. At some point, we probably don't have time for it at this conference, we ought to do a public presentation where you and I have a conversation like this radio show. And I think you could use the things you're talking about on this radio show. I mean, all of them should be repeated to the audience. And, of course, they'll come out somewhat differently, so you're still going to enjoy hearing her again. But I'd like all this stuff to be heard by the nutritionists. The audience will probably be predominantly nutritionists, but maybe that will change now that I'm co-sponsoring instead of just going there.
I think it will. I think it's going to be very eclectic, and I think it's going to be wonderful. But I will say this, and I mean it, and I'm not getting off this horse, that if we're going to talk nutrition, we have to start from the beginning, and that's with breastfeeding.
Well, yes. Now, I want you to think about also putting in there, if we want to talk about human life, we got to start at the basics, which is breastfeeding and relationship with mom.
Absolutely. And people don't understand how my research, because I have two different streams. I have this breastfeeding attachment parenting stream, and then I have the psychiatric drugging of children and adolescents stream, and people don't understand the connection. But for me, there's an intrinsically clear connection, and that is the relationship with mother. It all comes back into that root, to that most important root. Yeah. It's the foundation of all of us.
And what you're
saying,
if that
relationship is off kilter, everything's off kilter.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's still the case, you know. You know, as adults, we father and we mother each other, and if my ginger is off, I'm off, and if I'm off, ginger's off.
Yep.
No way around that. There's no way around being empathic, caring, and loving with your partner, and for you not to get a little off, and maybe even a lot off, if your partner is distressed or conflicted or suffering in any way.
You know, I have this radical...
And that happens with the baby. That's got to... What about the studies? Well, you've got this radical thought, give it, but also, what about the effect on a distress in a mother? What do we know scientifically about them? But go ahead.
I was going to say, I wanted to talk about this radical thought that I just had about dogs. I believe this, and I have no scientific data to back this up. Usually I don't talk about things unless I have scientific data to back it up. But with this one, I don't. But I really do think so many of us have dogs, love dogs, because they give us what we were missing in our childhood. And that's that sense of security, that unconditional love, that no matter what I'm loved, that's what we're all craving. Now, of course, I don't have data to support it, but there's a reason so many of us have dogs around us all the time, like me, like you.
Well, yes, I have my personal data. And about a month or so ago, we lost one of our two Shetland sheepdogs, who was the great-great-grandmother of the younger one. And we deeply believe that you don't just mourn your sit around and mourn the death of a dog, but it's really okay. Dog, your dog in heaven won't resent your getting another dog. And besides, our younger Sheltie, the great-great-granddaughter, you know, was obviously sad and in loss. So we broke a tradition of having generations of Shelties, and we got at Ginger's Wishes a little Yorkie. And it's not an ordinary-looking Yorkie. You know, Yorkies have a kind of a toughness to them, with dark heads often and dark faces. And this one's called a Party, P-A-R-T-I, colored Yorkie. It's actually golden. So this is a Yorkie that's kind of a gold-tan color with this sweet face. And she went through, I carried her home for a three-hour trip, and I was concerned that that would bond her too much with me as her first human. And then we got to the house, and we were sitting around a table, and I, you know, Ginger picked up the Yorkie for the first time. We just got out of the car in the house and held the Yorkie for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes, an hour, I don't know. It wasn't a long time. And I was there, and, of course, our other Sheltie, Sherry, was there. And all of a sudden, the Yorkie wanted to get down, and she made, we counted them after the third one. We could remember, my God, it's three, now it's four. The Yorkie made circles around Ginger, slow, continuous circles, glancing occasionally at me kind of over her shoulder, but looking up a lot at Ginger. And from then on, the Yorkie was Ginger's baby.
Oh, I love that.
2 days later, when Ginger went out, the next day when Ginger left, thinking, well, the dog has, you know, seen us both so much, it'll be fine. That I have it on video. She started letting out piteous wails, piteous, and running back and forth to the front door, piteous wails. And now that she's gotten really, it's been 2 weeks, and she's just firmly a part of Ginger, now she's really letting me be with her in the same way. And Ginger went out today, and I held the Yorkie in my lap while with a patient whom I knew well. And the effect of having a Yorkie rather than a 35-pound Sheltie or 25-pound Sheltie, having a 4-pound one, this is the bottom of weight for them, 3 to 4 pounds, four is supposed to be the lower normal limit. Having that little dog around has done something for Ginger that is miraculous. It slowed her down. My wife, you give my wife one piece of daylight to work, and she's at work, taking care of business matters, taking care of me, taking care of editing something of mine, promoting my work. She's doing something all the time. And the Yorkie in her lap slows her down, and she's getting more peaceful. That and the diet, which is Pam's diet, which has cured her in a matter of less than a month, and now it's been several months of severe, throughout her entire adulthood, gastrointestinal problem. So in Ginger, I see the two come together of relationship with the dog, and of course with me, and how much she appreciates my saying, sure, get a Yorkie, when of course I would have liked a 70-pound lab or something if we were giving up Shelby. Dogs give us what we're missing, or what human beings simply need. Maybe it's not even missing in childhood. It could still be something we need and want. That makes sense, doesn't it?
Makes perfect sense. I'm just so excited about this conference, and again, I hope some of your listeners can come. I just think it's going to be an amazing, amazing event.
Well, I mean, hearing you talk will be amazing. People have heard now. Anybody who listens to my show, you know who Peter Goetz is, and you can, it's spelled G-O-T-Z-S-C-H-E, and the O has this line through it. I forget what that's called, but Peter Goetz, you can find him on, I've had him on, I think, I had him on for a series of four sessions, because he is now the one person who's a medical person who is, in addition to me, doing these no-holds-barred, truthful examinations of what's going on in psychiatry with just no compromise with the truth. He's the great Danish physician I've mentioned. And he's going to be there, folks. I'll just repeat that. I mean, he's astonishing to listen to. He's more exciting than I am giving a lecture, because he's less politically correct. He's not an American. He's much less politically correct than I am when I talk. So he's a treat. So, Jeannie, I'm at a loss right now. I just so appreciate bringing these ideas together. Have you written stuff that they can just get online?
Yes, if they just Google my name, if they just Google Jeannie, it's J-E-A-N-N-E.
There's my dog, by the way, folks. Ginger's home, so my dog's barking. Go ahead.
Stolzer, S is in Sam, T-O-L-Z-E-R. Most of my work will come up, published on five different continents.
Jeannie, you keep talking while I get my dog out of here.
Okay. So I hope that your listeners will read some of my stuff. Again, I have two different research streams, the psychiatric drugging of infants, children, and adolescents, and I also do a lot with attachment parenting, co-sleeping, breastfeeding, and that kind of thing. Very important to socio-emotional health and also with our physical health. I call it the body-mind-spirit paradigm, that in order for that to be flourishing, we absolutely need a strong foundation and a strong attachment.
I'm back, by the way.
Are you back? Okay, you got the dogs. I went upstairs so my big German Shepherd quit barking, so I don't think he knows where I'm at.
We do run a lot of our lives around the dogs, and now Ginger is and I plan our lives a lot around what to do with our new little girl. She's so adorable. They should be. I never think of this. There should be some pictures of her up on social media, either on my page, which Ginger runs, or on her page. But you rarely see a Yorkie who looks so unterrier, unlike a terrier in terms of the sweet round face and the little curls and the gold yellow color.
I cannot wait to see her. But before I go, I do want to say this, and yes, it's quite radical, but you've known me long enough to know that sometimes radical things come out of my mouth. I really believe this, and I believe it with all my heart and my mind and my soul. We have to do something about these unprovoked mass shootings. We have to get in the streets and demand that our legislators at the state level, at the federal level, are listening to us. We're not going to have all these crazy debates anymore about guns and video games and bullying. We're going to get to the heart of the matter. It's time to get to the heart of the matter, and the heart of this matter is the mass drugging of Americans. It's killing people.
Well, I didn't even know what you were going to say, Jeannie.
I didn't know what I was going to say either, but I've had
it. The mass drugging is contributing hugely to this, and I thought you might say relationship. We have got to develop some greater sense of being Americans and caring for one another, and we have to... what you're talking about with the raising of children, I doubt very much whether this mass murderer was nursed for 2 or 3 years. you know,
but a lot of us had problems. I was never nursed. My mother's doctor told her to feed me Karo syrup and evaporated milk. That was my formula, but I don't have any inclination to go, you know, mass murder anybody. But if you put me on some Valium and some Cymbalta, when it says right on the label, right on the insert, that it can cause suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, violent psychoses, we've got to stop tiptoeing around this issue. And I'm talking about this issue of unprovoked mass murder. We're a murderous species, the human species is. We've always killed for turf wars and religious reasons and this and that. We've always done that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about walking into a school and killing babies, 5 and 6 year old babies at their desk, or concert goers from a window, just shooting at random people. It's senseless, but there is a common denominator in each of these shootings, and it's time we take to the streets and demand that they listen. It's enough.
Well, I am so with you on that. So many of the mass murderers were literally on psychiatric drugs leading up to and shortly before, and I've been involved as an expert in some of their cases, so I know it's for sure. And Columbine, Eric Harris, for sure. The theater shooter in Aurora, Colorado, been involved in his case, for sure. Put on
Virginia Tech, for sure. They're for sures, all up and down the line.
Yeah.
Not speculation, for sure.
And where we don't have a for sure about the drugging, almost every single case has had contact with psychiatry. You know, and another one that nobody ever talks about because it disappeared from the pages of the Washington Post was in Washington, D.C., where the Naval Yard shooter from several years ago,
yes.
His case, we had documented evidence because the VA came out and said it before they realized what they were saying, that he had recently visited a clinic and been put on the antidepressant trazodone. Boy, that
yep.
disappeared fast. So there's just so much of that. So out of all the things that make us so dangerous, you know, maybe it's right for you and me. I get a little shy sometimes about saying that you know, my work, the work I want to do is so central, but it is. And that is the one thing that we could change most readily would be to stop using psychiatric drugs all the time. Jeannie, it's wrap-up time.
Thank you so much for having me, and I cannot wait to see you in Columbus, Ohio at the conference. It'll be so wonderful. Can't wait.
Jeannie Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R. Tell folks about this show and like us or whatever else you do out there on the web. Bye-bye, you wonderful listening audience. Bye-bye now.